truth of the matter was, stories was everything, and everything was stories. Everybody told stories. It was a way of seeing who they were in the world. It was their understanding of themselves.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
If we think of the word mutant, it comes from mutagenic, mutation. Now, a mutation is when you irrevocably change a genetic structure. So you add a mutation to a developing gene structure, and it mutates, it changes. And then when that organism reproduces, it carries with it the added mutation. But a tetration is when it changes the molecular structure of that being, but it can't be passed on. A genetic difference happens, but it only happens of that generation and that generation alone, and then it reverts back to that which it had previously been for the subsequent generations. So you'd look at me and think, oh, he's a mutant. There was a mutation in his genetic development, but actually I'm a tetrant. So if I were to have kids, they would revert back to the genes that my mother had before she took the drug.
You know, I love political incorrectness and going against the grain and stuff. We can talk about what was considered disgusting and cool, but that changes with eras. But the thing that doesn't change is the gut fascination with the different. Let's say it's somebody feeding themselves with chopsticks when they're using their feet. It's amazing. It's still riveting for the five-year-old who's just walked into the restaurant, right? Because I'm just as fascinated by physical difference as the next person. But, you know, there's a negative way of looking, and then there's positive ways of looking. You've kind of struck me dumb here because it's a question I can't answer. And I'm trying to be super open, and I am fascinated by it, and I don't know why. Okay, I am painting this rosy, guys. I am painting this rosy. But why not? Nobody ever does. The circus comes to town. It's exciting. It's sexy. It smells weird. And there's a group of weird fucking people like me who are like, dude, come with us. We are on the road all the time. We get wankered every single night. We get paid. We're autonomous. We're fiscally independent. What you got? I mean, you know, I'd have jumped straight on the bandwagon, you know. My name's Matt Fraser. I'm 51. I was born and bred in London. And I travel the world extensively doing my weird performance work. For listeners who are never going to see a photo, I've got truncated arms, my upper arms, which are just shorter than where maybe an elbow would be, and then my hands turn in like a foot from a leg inwards towards my body, and I have no thumbs. And that's actually the most profound part of my impairment, the lack of the opposable digit, because it didn't evolve and make people the best beings on the planet for nothing. You know, it's a pretty wondrous tool. And without it, you can still manage fine. But I mean, I do a lot of things with two hands that you guys do with one, and not just, you know, the obvious, you know. My dad died when I was like 21 of abdominal cancer, and he was an old-fashioned hoofer, gay, closeted for many years. Yeah, my mum still is. She's in a musical at the moment in London, kind of fringe, off Broadway kind of thing. And that's fun. She's happy because it's a smash hit and everyone is sold out. She was on tour, had morning sickness. It was went to a local doctor in whatever town. He prescribed this brand new drug. She took it three times in 1 week, and I came into the world like this, a monstrous deformity, as it were.
Hundreds of babies have been born deformed. Some of them without arms, simply because their mothers, in the early stage of their pregnancy, took a new drug.
And thalidomide was a drug that was invented in the late 50s for women with morning sickness and general painkiller.
The reason it was hailed as a wonder drug was because it was the first ever non-barbiturate sedative, which meant that if you took loads of it, you couldn't die from an overdose. It was, quote, completely safe for mother and child.
In its varied forms, it would take away your headache, put you to sleep and calm you.
And they were so, you know, confident in it that they marketed like a child version of it. And it was flying off the shelves. It hadn't been tested properly. And it wasn't until an Australian doctor, Bill McBride, thought, hold on a minute. So he started to do his own tests on New Zealand white rabbits. And they all came out, not so much with deformed limbs, but there were just far fewer than there should have been. And some had malformed limbs. So he sent his findings to the British medical journal, The Lancet. It apparently got lost for 6 months, the letter, during which time no doubt backroom boys were scrambling about trying to cover their asses for the oncoming litigation. And the whole thing was the first proper medical pharmaceutical corporate crime of history. It's because of thalidomide that every single drug now has. If you're pregnant, please seek the advice of a physician before taking this drug. So I'm a thalidomide victim, a thalidomider, as we call ourselves these days. Kind of neutral, judgment-free explanation of what we are, rather than victim or survivor, which is whatever. I want to go back to my mum, though, because I know a lot of people always want to know this. What was it like for my mum? She came to for the grogginess and was like, no baby. Okay, an hour went past, something's wrong, 2 hours, 3 hours, and then 4 hours went past. She convinced herself by then that the baby was dead and that they weren't going to be able to tell her. You know, it was going to be difficult for them to confront her with it. And then they came in with me very tightly wrapped, you know, so you couldn't tell, in other words. And as they put me into her lap and arms, she was making the mother-child bonding connection with the eyes. She said it was like looking at an old friend or something like that. While they were going, got some very bad news from you, your son has really short arms. Then she thought, oh, is that all? Because she thought I was dead, you know. So to her, it was a relief. No doubt over the next week, the reality hit her like a concrete block. And this is typical of a lot of the parents. The angst that a parent feels when they bring a disabled kid into the world, apart from that it was monstrously different and shocking for everybody, on a like level of deformity thing, the angst that most parents suffer is that, you know, they're like, oh crap, my kid has really got it stacked against him. He's gonna have to fucking fight like shit all his life, and I won't be there for half that fight, and I feel bad about that. A lot of parents had a really hard time. Yeah, a lot of us kids did. I didn't, and my mum didn't, so we got along fine. I'm sure she felt really shit when she saw me toddle off on my first day at primary school on my own for the first time. Everyone's first day at school is difficult, isn't it? Because you suddenly realise that there's a whole big life out there and you've got to be part of it. And when you're weird and different, it's kind of more scary, I suppose. But also when you're seven, you're blissfully ignorant of anything outside of your own experience. I had to deal with some kids who were unused to difference and reacted in a traditional Western way, i.e. teasing me. But, you know, kids are non-judgmental. They don't give a fuck about, you know, who's got what. They have to be taught that shit from adults, right? It's incredible. But by the time you hit about 9 or 10, then the insecure kid will start bullying you, and the kid who's unhappy at home will start being really nasty to you. Because we know that bullies are just scared people anyway. By the time you hit 13, 14, when you're super sensitive and wondering about girls or boys, as the case may be, whatever it was, girls with me, you know, it all kicks in at them. So that can be pretty difficult. But, you know, the angst that I suffered in my 13-year-old bedroom about girls and not being tough and not being one of the gang is just the same as the fat kid or the kid that had the really pizza face. You know, the level of angst that you go through as an individual, I suspect, is the same. For the most part, I was very happy. I've always been very gregarious and social, and I like talking to people. And for the most part, they like talking to me. Always very outgoing, always doing little plays for my grandparents when I'd stay with them, and little performances at home. But the first one was probably about when I was 12 or 13 in secondary school or high school for you guys. And we had English lessons, and the guy said, you all have to write a five-minute play. And then I wrote one, and a few people laughed at a couple of my gag lines. And that, I mean, you know, as any creative will tell you, your first, like, positive reaction to a piece of art that you've thrown out is such a... It's like a mainline drug to the DNA spine. You're just, like, hooked for the rest of your life, you know?
Well, my mum was having an affair with a drummer in the 70s.
And he kept a drum kit around at my house. And I said, well, if you're going to have a drum kit around at my house, will you set it up in my bedroom? And he showed me the rudimentary paradiddle, which is right, left, right, right, left, right, left, left. You can apply that to bass, snare, bass, bass, snare, bass, snare, snare. I got the bug immediately. How do I drum? Well, I drum in the conventional way. If any of you have ever looked over the orchestra pit in a theatre at the interval, to look down at all the instruments, and you've looked at the drum kit, and it's all like squashy, like the cymbals are overhanging the tom-toms, and the whole thing's like it's been squashed into the corner. That's how I kind of play my kit, because I can't reach things very far away, so everything has to be brought in for me. The way I hold my sticks, I don't have opposable digits, thumbs, and so I hold my sticks very differently. But the human brain's amazing, is really the best way to answer that. Drummed away listening to records and trying to copy the drumming in my bedroom for a very loud, painful for my mother, 2 years. And then punk rock exploded. And it said, you don't need to play your instrument properly. You don't need to look proper. You don't need to be one of those sort of jacket sleeve rolled up to the elbow, glam metal, white snake type. You can be a dirty fucking fucked up piece of shit and you can still play music. In fact, that we'd rather you were like that. And I'm like, well, I'm that. I said to Dan, my best friend, I want to be a punk. He said, me too. I said, what can we do with my school jacket? So he ripped the entire thing in half of the back seam and then put it back together again with a spine of safety pins. I thought I was the shit. My teachers didn't agree. And I literally, overnight, went from being the school cripple to the school punk. Secure. Let me tell you, that was an upgrade when it came to identity. Big, big time. I could take all the... You think you're a punk, do you? We hate punks. And I got smacked about a bit. Every time I got hit because I was a punk, it was verification of the fact that I wasn't being hit because I was disabled. So they didn't know, but I, at a subconscious level, was enjoying it.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
And then before I knew where I was in a punk band. The bands I was in were A Fear of Sex. We didn't have a bass player. It was a very alternative. The Reasonable Strollers, certainly the worst title band I was ever in. Living in Texas, a comment on being in Britain might as well be the 51st state. Joyride, which was pure speed punk. I was the only man in the band, and all the songs were about what assholes men are.
Don't touch me!
Really good stuff. I fucking had a great time. There was a connectivity, there was a community. There was something to be a part of. And it was also railing against society, which I needed to rail against. It was like everything I needed and wanted. And I jumped in hook, line and sinker, you know. So one of the things with disability, one of the things disabled people do is reject that label because it's so negative to them. And, you know, let's not talk about whether we're talking about people with disabilities or disabled people. Let's not break down the language so far, or handicapped instead of disabled. They don't like the label. They don't like being labelled with it because for them and for most of society, it means inferior, lesser, in need of help, pathetic, not self-sufficient, and all the things that we strive to prove that we're not in this modern world. So what's weird about it is that I was in total denial of my disability for many, many years. I was a punk, always had my alternative stripes pinned to my chest and still do, but avoided disability as a subject like the plague because it embarrassed me and I found it difficult. Then I went to a thalidomide conference in 1991 in Holland, and I met a woman called Mary Duffy, who's an Irish artist who, with no arms, who paints with her feet and mouth and what have you. She said, the trouble with you is, Matt, you don't think you're disabled. And I said, I'm not, because I can do this, I can do that. And she said, no, disability isn't what you can do. It's a social construct. It's how you're treated because you're different. It's a disabling process. It makes you less in society. You know, that really struck a chord with me.
I went back to London and I sought out the disability rights movement. At the time, around about 95, there was a group called Disability Rights UK, and they were a very sort of polite pressure group. And they would do events that we would mass demonstration. Now, I come from sort of much more underground culture. So I went along, and then I immediately spotted that, like, the nutters, the tough guys. And they were like, we're part of a different organisation called Direct Action Network. Dan, yeah, you're the guys I like.
The thing
I'm
like
be a Danner.
About Dan is that it's in your face.
Politically demonstrate by night and, like, do illegal things and run across roads and jump down onto rail tracks and really cause
what
a lot of shit.
What people are doing is going out, breaking down all the ideas or a lot of them.
There was a guy called Robin who had no legs and could run on his hands so fast. And one time I remember he ran up a policeman and jumped onto the van and was on top of the police van and they couldn't quite reach him and he was just mocking them. And that was really, really awesome. Until he got arrested, of course.
Right,
we all got arrested.
To be the right able to be live able
a
to
normal life,
live
and
a normal
without,
life,
and
able
without,
body,
treating us
able
like
body,
shit,
treating us like shit.
We had stopped public transport from operating in a certain area because it was not accessible to wheelchair users. And they weren't coming to the discussion table. And so more extreme action we felt was required. And so they were like, we need two people to go under that bus and handcuff themselves to the exhaust pipe so that you physically can't be removed. So this woman went, Matt, you good? And I was like, yep, let's go. I don't remember the name of the lady. She was from the Midlands. She had a leg impairment. She was just a random housewife who'd had enough of not being treated like an equal, not being able to get on her bus to do her shopping. Is it too much to ask for, you know, to have access to public transport? Not really. And we were both the chosen people to go under that bus. There were, like, several vehicles around, and actually it was one of those ones where when you turn off the ignition, the suspension slowly goes down and the bus was slowly coming down on top of us as well. And everyone was freaking out.
The bus is sinking, they're gonna die.
So there I was with my disability protest friend under a bus. It was 3 days of protesting. And I said, oh, you know, it's funny. I should really be an audition. I had my first audition, acting audition. But this is much more important. And she's like, what the fuck are you talking about, you stupid asshole? Very few of us are going to be able to audition, let alone get the part and do something and be visible and be like part of the media. Any one of us can handcuff ourselves under the bus. But some of us can do it in different ways. Get the hell out of here.
I think my mum must have been very in tune. She said, do you want to go to a play? I was like, yeah, I love going to plays, Mum. Yeah, let's go to a play. And we went to a play, and it was a play by a theatre company.
A remarkable touring company of disabled actors.
And I went and I watched a spazzy bloke with cerebral palsy unintelligibly mumble and dribble at the front of the stage. I was intensely embarrassed. People in wheelchairs fucking whizzing around, crutches, all of it. It was a cavalcade of weirdness. And then after 5 minutes, I understood him, because you tune into people with speech differences after a while. And I was like, this is really cool. You know, it just hit me like a tidal wave. And I realised I really wanted to be an actor and a performer. inclusive of my disability, not like pretend I didn't have it. So I got a profile in Britain. I was knocking on the door of TV going, I want to do a documentary about freak shows, because everyone said, don't do freak shows. It's the pornography of the disabled. And the more they say that, the more you want to do it, you know. And I found an American director who was really into old vaudeville who wanted to do it. And I thought, between us, this is brilliant, because he's got the American history and I've got the modern day stuff. And we did a big documentary called Born Freak in 2001.
And I discovered that throughout history, disabled people had been working as entertainers, as gladiators, court jesters, as freaks.
A freak show is one where people come out and display their own common difference, whether that's their body or their behaviour or a skill that they've learned.
There are fat ones. They're all inside.
And they do it to entertain the crowd, but whilst at the same time giving them a sort of patter that educates the audience about that difference. Of course there were people who were exploited because their parents didn't want them, nobody wanted them, and then somebody profited and said, I'll look after them, and then sold them on, and then they just sold from one person to the other. Of course that happened. But you know what? Percentage-wise, I'm reckoning it's got to be down to about 5 to 3%, because most of the time there were people who managed and produced themselves who made a crap load of money. One of whom was, I'd heard that this guy, CeeLo the Seal Boy, who was a freak show performer from 1929, I think, to 78.
Stanley with arms Barrett like mine. Was an American freak show entertainer from the 1940s who looked like me. He had phocomelia. That's the medical term for my condition. It literally means seal-like limbs.
So I researched him, and I found out that he had...
Coney Island, the world's greatest fun frolic, with its beach miles long, all peppered with people. The place where merriment is king.
Coney Island in 1912 could boast 10,000 different novelty acts. Took myself down to Coney Island one day. If you've never been, it's the full length of the queue of the N or the R train. You go through all the worst projects and then you finally arrive at this old beach resort that looks very dilapidated. And I walked up and there was all these banners and yeah, it looked like a freak show. And I walked up and knocked on the iron door and a guy, a crazy guy with a top hat and curly hair looked at me and he went, hello, you're home. I got to know Dick Z. Egan, the unofficial mayor of Coney Island and total hero, I think, of sideshow culture. A man with two different theatre degrees, so he knows his shit. We set up the interview. He said, well, why don't you interview me on the stage, all the history around us? And I said, so I wonder what it's like, you know, performing as a freak. I mean, you know, it's so brutal and direct, and I'm an actor, and there's always an artifice. And he just looked at me and said, well, you either shit or get off the pot, don't you? Why don't you just come and work the weekend? And he said, it's live on camera. So I was like, yeah, okay, because it made a good bit of TV. I joined the cast on the Saturday, and they filmed all the rotations. Then they all went away, and then Dick was like, but you're coming back tomorrow. You said you'd work the whole weekend. I'm like, dude, give me a break. I said, but I don't want to do the Seal of the Seal Boy act. Can I just try and like modern stuff? He said, do whatever the hell you want. I don't care what you do. I just want you in the show. And I found that I could do a modern version of CeeLo's act and do stand-up and get a dig in at the pharmaceutical companies and talk about the FDA. Because, you know, you guys didn't get thalidomide because the FDA back then was good and did their job. And I had this tattoo. I'm showing the guys a tattoo on the outside of my ankle that says CeeLo at Coney Island 2001. Because after that first rotation, I was so pumped and psyched that I ran straight upstairs where they had a tattooist. And they had a quiet. I said, stick it on me now before I change my mind, you know, and then ran back downstairs and did the next rotation. It was awesome.
I don't know what a carny is, whether you're always a carny. A carny is something in your heart, man, or whether, no, you have to have actually been born in carny land or whatever it is. But I did, and I felt like a carny.
What I didn't count for was you simultaneously have all and none of the power. You have none of the power because they're, you know, potentially, because they've come to just look at the difference that you are. But you're talking and they're listening. So you get to say what is discussed. You get to imprint into their brains. And I realised the intoxicating power of that. And I'm like, but dude, I don't do anything. The guy before me just lay on a fucking bed of nails, risked his life, got hung up by his nipples, and I'm on just going, yes, I don't have a humerus, and I don't have a, and it's because to this day feel guilty about the really talented guys, the self-made freaks, and the actually skilled people who do stuff. I'm reasonably skilled at the patter, and I'm not a bad stand-up comedian, but I can't do amazing sideshow skills. I have none. I learned to do mousetrap on the tongue. And it really, really hurts. And I just thought, I don't want to do that 8 times a day, you know. Suffice to say, I did feel like I'd come home. As a performer, as a human, as a combination of everything I was and was interested in. So I became part of their network and family and worked every summer there.
Coney Island, a mecca by day, a glittering spectacle by night.
The two most bizarre things I've done off the top of my head were I was in character as Seal Boy at a very posh art function up in Times Square. People were not digging me. They couldn't look me in the eye. And I had 3 hours to go before I was going to get paid. I was like, oh, this is a bit of a drag. Somebody said, or you could go over there, take all your clothes off and get painted from head to toe in warm Belgian chocolate. Have your photo taken. Then you can just fuck off. And I'm like, yep, I'm there. Let's go. So me and my wife ran over there, stripped off, got covered in warm Belgian chocolate, which was an amazingly erotic experience, I have to tell you. And then because the person running it was friends with the chief of police of Times Square, we got a weird police escort down 2 blocks, walking naked with a police escort in the middle of Times Square at like 11 p.m. at the weekend. That was one weird this thing. Last year, I was in the opening ceremony of the Paralympics, mime drumming Spasticus Autisticus. And there we were playing in front of the Queen. It was beautiful roundup. And unbeknownst to me, Chris Martin, the lead singer of Coldplay, was watching the telly. And 2 days later, I got a call from him that went something like this. Hello, Matt, it's Chris Martin from the band Coldplay. I thought, I fucking know who you are, mate. Do you know what I mean? Basically, long story short, I ended up drumming the following Sunday as guest drummer on one song for the Coldplay gig at the closing ceremony 2 weeks later. I asked them not to play Fix You. He said, mate, we're already ahead of you. Of course we can't do that. That would be totally wrong at the Paralympics, you know? That whole thing was incredibly weird. Fantastic, brilliant. This is the thing I've got to tell you. So before the gig, before like we're like being ushered along the thing, you know, it was a huge stadium, 75,000 people. I was crapping myself. And he goes, okay, big circle. He goes, so-and-so, go and get Jay-Z and Rihanna, because they were like guest artists on it, right? And he's like, okay, huddle up, bring it in. Jay, Rihanna, this is Matt. Hi. You know, I'm thinking this is really weird. Thank you three so much for being in this. I'm like, wow, what a fucking brilliant guy to include me. And then he goes, okay, hand in the middle. Now, most of us know what's going to happen next, right? Like, put your hand in the middle and go, whoa. Jay-Z had not done that before. And he went, oh, are you guys going to, or something like that? And we were like, yeah. And so we did that. And I was like, wow, I just saw Jay-Z be like a schoolboy or something. That was incredibly cute. I shouldn't have told the general public that, but I'm sure I won't get sued. Again, lovely people. But when it was done, I woke up on the following Monday and my life was back to normal. Bank account, tiny bit bigger. Great memories.
I was doing my own project with my performer wife, Juliet Lasmussen. And so we all worked together to make an adult version of Beauty and the Beast.
They're not calling Lord, my name is Beast.
Super fun and full of love, and everybody comes out crying and happy. It's the perfect piece. Well, we did that in London last December and smashed it really over the rocks, over the pebbles of theatre land. And then we came to New York and did it, and again smashed it. And we got the best review ever in the New York Times from Ben Brantley, who's the theatre critic there, the big scary theatre critic. If it's his thumb up, you do well. If it's his thumb down, you're finished. You know, that kind of thing. And amazingly, we got the best ever review that anyone's ever read of anything he's ever written. And meanwhile, a woman was in town thinking, I wonder what I'll do tonight, and read the reviews. Thought, oh, that's rather a glowing review. Maybe I'll go along. She went along, and then she saw me on stage and thought, hold on, my friend, she's doing some kind of freaky TV thing. I'll give her a call. I'm currently in New Orleans because in May I received an email from American Horror Story out of the blue saying, please audition for us. We run 14th of July to 14th of December. So I did my photo booth audition and sent it to them, emailed it to them, and then 24 hours later they offered me the part. And then we negotiated a couple of things. I didn't want to have my face tattooed. They wanted me to play the illustrated character. And I thought to myself, I'm absolutely buggered if I'm going to be on a hugely high-profile American TV show, my first screen work in America. And obviously people will recognise me because of my arms, but I'm buggered if I'm going to have my face obscured. I want people to recognise it. It's the feature that sells me. And so it's the combo of my arms and my face that sells me to the next job. And so I need that combo. Then they relented, which was great.
Tired of being laughed at and being attacked. Been called Seal Boy. The world hated me. For no more than I hated myself.
You know, I know I'm meant to be on this programme. I know it's my destiny to be on this programme. I have researched, I've been an actor and a freak show performer for over 15 years and been fully aware that at some point somebody would combine a high-budget screen drama with and use real freaks in a freak show story. And that all I had to do was just stay treading water in that genre, be ever present and ready, keep taking work, and that I would be in the front runner for that. I really enjoyed being on the biggest ever drama I've ever been in, where 150 people work on the production at any given time. The funniest thing was, it was at the Avenue Pub and on St. Charles, and somebody came up to me and went, excuse me, aren't you in American Horror Story? And everyone did side looking at each other, thinking, oh, this is a bit weird. Yeah, thinking, have you not noticed that I'm with three of the major stars of the show? Can I have my photo with you? And I went, yeah. And he had my photo, and then he walked off. He didn't even recognise the others, because he'd just seen my arms. He'd probably only seen the show once, just seen my arms, knew that those were the same arms on the show, and walked off. And the others thought it was really funny, because obviously they are sick to death of having that happen to them. But they looked incredulous. I said, it's the flippers, they do it every time. You know, they pull focus. Freak, I mean, freakishly different. It's an outrageous, rare difference, a freakish thing. The freak show that we portray in American Horror Story certainly is that. Well, I hope that the science show develops. I hope it keeps weird. I hope it always welcomes deformed people into it. I see an Applebee's has opened across the street from the Coney Island science show. And everyone's welcoming that, and great. We do need to get rid of the smack crackhead image of Coney Island. But what if one day in 6 to 7 to 10 years' time, the owner of the last empty lot that is now a chain reaction and looks and goes, hey, Mr. Applebee's, Mr. McDonald's, Mr. Dunkin' Donuts, see that freak show over there? They don't belong here. And then it's all condos and posh people. That's what I hope doesn't happen, and I hope they stay their ground. I definitely think that having my disability has helped me become the artist I am and made me more resourceful. Many of the avenues available to fairly middle-class, white, tall guys are not open to me. So I've had to think outside a lot of boxes from a very early age, and that gives you a lateral way of looking at things. You mix into that, survival techniques
And that does make me more creative and more resourceful and hopefully more productive. There's nothing wrong with not being able to wipe your own asshole. It could happen to any of us, listeners. It could happen to any of us. We think it's the living end of life and it's only fucking shit. You'd get used to it. We all would.
I'm a politicized disabled person, so I was disabled but didn't want to be called disabled. Then learnt what disability really means in a social, political context. And now I'm very proud to call myself disabled, because to me, disabled doesn't mean all the things I listed earlier. Inferior, lesser, in need of help, pathetic. It means the following list. It means given a shit card, but dealt with it anyway. Learned how to fight, learned how to find an alternative voice when nobody wanted you to have one. And all those, it's the fight, it's a badge of honor, because it means you're a warrior.
So in the last 5 years, I've not done any other activism at all. I've kept it to just in my work. All I want to do now is reflect society in my work. I will always have a disabled character or more in there. And all I want them to do is interact and have their life. Because I've learned, the more you want something to be about something, the less you talk about it. You just set it in a situation.
We've all got the right to be anything we want to be. I like being disabled. I like wearing it on my sleeve. I like being an out and proud disabled person because it's a societal struggle in the same way that queer people call themselves queer. Fist in the air. If I had a fist, it would be in the air right now, punching it for disability. But instead, I have feet, so I kick for disability.
You've been listening to Everything is Stories, a podcast brought to you by Oscilloscope Laboratories. The episode you just heard was produced by Garrett Crow, Mike Martinez, and Tyler Ray. Music in this episode was provided by the band PC Worship. You can find links to their music at our website, everythingisstories.com. While you're there, you can find all of our past episodes, a way to subscribe to our newsletter, as well as photos from this episode taken by our friend Robert Johansson. You can find Everything is Stories by searching the internet. We're everywhere. We're on all the social media platforms and anywhere you listen to podcasts. Follow us, subscribe, and engage with us. Tell all your friends. Recommendations are always the best way to find a new podcast. Thanks for listening. And remember, nothing comes from nothing, and everything is stories.
Whatever else Graham Greene does, he always tells you a story. Not his old introspective musing and grousing and chewing your liver. Let's get on with the story. Keep me up tonight with this story you're telling me. I want to turn the page. All I ever wanted to be and all I think of myself as being is a storyteller. That's all. I just tell stories.